About 53 degrees. Wednesday and Thursday, sunny days, a high just about 74 Wednesday, 78 on Thursday. 81 right now in downtown Butler. I'm Tracy Morgan in the NextTier Bank studios, Newstime 1230. NextTier Bank, your hometown community bank. Dave Malarkey's up next with It's Your Turn. Thanks so much for joining us, and have a good day.
And now, It's Your Turn with Dave Malarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's Your Turn. Weekdays from 1230 to 2 on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's Your Turn. 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us on the Monday edition of It's Your Turn. We say this every Monday. What happened to the weekend, huh? Whoosh. Gone by in a flash. Well, this coming weekend, in case you haven't noticed on your calendar, it's a long one. Yeah. This is the last Monday in June. July arrives on Friday, and a week from today is the 4th of July. Next Monday is 4th of July, so this coming weekend will be a long holiday weekend. It'll go fast, too. We have a good program today. It's a book talk day, and that's one of our popular features here on It's Your Turn. We're also going to be talking later on with an economist. Now, don't be frightened by that. In fact, it's a Nobel Prize-winning economist. His name is Alvin E. Roth. He was a co-recipient of the Nobel Prize in Economics 4 years ago. We're going to be talking about matching markets, where money isn't the only factor in determining who gets what. And this is something I never even thought about before until I started reading about Mr. Roth. And this could be anything from, where are you going to go to college, who you're going to marry, if you're going to marry, and a bunch of other stuff, too. Matching markets. No money's involved, but you have to find a match. So we'll talk about that. He's one of the world's leading experts in design theory and game theory. Alvin Roth will be with us a little bit later on the program today. But first, we say hi to Kathy Klein from North Trails Public Library here with us for book talk today. Kathy, good to see you.
Good to see you, David. Always a pleasure to be here talking about books.
Indeed, indeed. And we have an epic to discuss today, a novel by Jacqueline Michard. Now, I've never seen this woman interviewed. I may be mispronouncing her name. I'll tell you how I took a guess. Jacqueline, and it's the French spelling
Correct.
Of Jacqueline, so I'm thinking it must be Michard.
You're pronouncing it the way I've always pronounced it. So if I'm pronouncing it wrong, I've been doing that for probably 35 years. So
I said to him in my mind's eye, I said, Jacqueline Michard. I said, no, that can't be right. That can't be right. It's got to be Michard.
It doesn't roll off the tongue right, does it? Yeah.
And I guess if I'd been watching Oprah, I don't know, 15 years ago or whatever it was, she started her Oprah's book club. This author was the very first author chosen to be on Oprah's book club.
Yes, it was.
It wasn't this book, of course. It was her first novel, as a matter
of fact. It was.
It
was. I'm trying to think of what the name of it was.
It's something about in the deep ocean, but beyond the deep ocean. The deep end of the ocean.
The deep end of the ocean. There you go.
Deep end of the ocean.
Yeah.
I was surprised because I was not familiar with her. I certainly don't claim to be familiar with every author, of course, but number one, Oprah's book club was remarkable in that nobody had ever done anything like that before.
Right.
And I don't know, is Oprah still on? She has her own network.
She doesn't have a show
anymore.
I don't think she, but you know, for some reason I want to say if you go to her website, I think that book club discussion may still be ongoing. I'm not sure on that, though.
Well, when she started, and it had to be at least 15 years or maybe longer, when she started Oprah's book club, if you were selected to, you know, if you were the book of the month, she did it every month, you had a guaranteed bestseller. Because these authors would appear on her show and the sales of their book would just skyrocket. They'd go through the roof.
Yeah, and I think what she did is if you wanted to be part of the discussion, you could submit, and somehow they were selected. And I think she actually flew people out, and they gathered and
really?
They talked.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I often thought, oh, I should do this, and then I never got around to it.
Well, it was a great success back in the day, and I was intrigued to find out that, and of course, this author publicizes that. Why wouldn't you if you were the first author
Absolutely.
Ever chosen to be on Oprah's book club?
I cannot tell you how many books through the years book discussion clubs have selected books based on the fact that they were part of the Oprah book club.
Well, I lost my page here. I had the page of other works by all. Here it is. 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. So she's now written 10 novels. The Deep End of the Ocean was the first one. And this one that we're talking about today, Two If by Sea, is her latest.
And those are just novels for adults. She has also written some young adult, and she has also written some children's books.
Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah. So she's, I think, for me, the author is well known, you know, in publications.
Mm-hmm. Well, New York Times bestseller, but until North Trails selected this book, I had not heard of her and not read any of her other stuff. We'll talk a little bit about her later. Let's talk about the novel, Two If by Sea. This is what I would call an epic, a sweeping epic.
Kind of took you everywhere, didn't it?
It did, and I was talking about it this morning, promoting the fact that you were going to be here and we were going to be talking about it, and that's what I said. Well, it's kind of an epic. Kind of like, Leon Uris used to write. But then I said, I don't know whether I'd put her in the same category as Leon Uris, but it's that kind of a, you know, broad sweeping. It's on, the story takes place on three different continents.
It does, and I think some of the, I wouldn't have minded if it was a little bigger, because there were some areas of it that I wanted to know more, that for me, I think it would have made a better read.
Well, the three main areas, parts of the world where the novel takes place, are Australia and the United States, specifically Wisconsin, and then England. I found the English portion the most interesting. That's the one I like the best. It's at the end.
It is. It's at the end. And actually, yeah, because I kind of thought, when I put the book down, I thought, okay, what is this book about? And I thought, well, it's about a grieving man, a young boy with a telepathic gift, and horses.
Yeah, if you're a horse lover, folks, you'll love this book, despite the title, you know, which sounds like it, you know, should be about Mutiny on the Bounty
Two If by Sea.
When I mentioned it on the early morning show today, my morning colleague Kate said, what is it about the Revolutionary War? I said, no, that was Paul Revere, Two If by Sea. This has nothing to do with that. But she loves horses, and I said, you know, you'll love this book because it's all about horses. Both of the two main characters are involved with horses one way or another. It is, however, a sweeping epic novel, and because of that, there's a gazillion characters.
There is.
Yeah, and I don't mind a sweeping novel. It's hard to keep track of.
Yeah, they kind of they come and go.
And she has this, to me, annoying habit of only mentioning their first names.
Yeah.
So, she's talking about Harry and Eden and somebody else.
Cedric. Don't forget Cedric.
Yeah, and I'm thinking, who are these people? I'm mixed up with whose sister, whose brother-in-law, whose uncle, especially whenever they end up going back and forth from the United States to England. I just found that. I said, please, last names. Identify these people. I ended up making a chart of the main characters just so I could keep the relationships straight and so I could Make half sense, at least, when I talk to you.
I remembered Frank, Claudia, Ian, and Colin.
Well, those are certainly the four central characters. Let's talk about Frank Mercy, first of all. He would be the central character. And the story opens up. We're not going to tell you everything about it, obviously. You wouldn't enjoy the novel, I don't think. But it opens up in Australia.
Brisbane,
Australia, and on the night of, it's over the holidays, Christmas
Eve.
And there's a tsunami, unfortunately.
Yes. Now, we have to remember that this is a work of fiction,
mm-hmm.
because for some reason I'm not sure in my memory that I don't believe that Australia is susceptible to tsunamis.
It's
because,
not.
Because of the outline, the geography. And
absolutely.
Am I remembering that correctly, David?
Yeah, the coral okay. reef, the Great Barrier Reef or whatever. And it's interesting because some of the reviews I read of the book, there were people that jumped all over her for that. Well, you know, it's a novel, folks. Okay.
Yeah.
Obviously, at least to me, what she was taking off on, what, there was a killer tsunami in that part of the world about 5 years ago. In fact, mm-hmm. I think it was almost exactly 5 years ago. But that was in Indonesia.
Correct.
Which is not all that far from Australia, but it's a different part of the Indian Ocean.
Yeah, and it felt to me like she was playing the author's what-if game,
mm-hmm.
which is fine, but our readers are very smart. You know, there were I can remember one time that reading a book, and it took place in England, and unfortunately, I haven't had a chance to research this much, but there was a scene, and they had a hummingbird. And it just kind of rang untrue to me because I don't believe that England has hummingbirds.
Hmm. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, like I said, that's been a good number of years ago, and I still haven't had time to research it. But, you know, so you have to be very careful when you are right. You want to make it as authentic,
mm-hmm.
you know, to the land, to wherever it is you're setting this novel, because we have some very smart readers.
Well, she wanted, I guess, it to be in Australia because of the fact that it's a former British colony and so on and so forth.
Exactly.
It does end up in England, remember? This book was just published in March
Correct.
Of this year. It's brand new. So I'm thinking she had to, you know, remember the tsunami in Indonesia, which
claimed a
huge number of lives.
Yep.
So anyway, Frank is there with his wife. His first wife, Natalie, who is pregnant with their first child.
Yes.
Frank Mercy, the central character, he's a retired cop.
He is from Chicago? Am I remembering that
Somewhere
correct?
In the Midwest, yeah.
Yeah, he was. He retired because he was injured on permanent disability,
mm-hmm.
had to retire.
Banged his leg up.
Correct.
Still bothers him, yeah.
Correct, yeah.
But he is a... He comes from a family of, he grew up on a horse farm, family of horse lovers in Wisconsin. And so he's a horse lover. He's there with Natalie. And he had, I can't remember exactly the reason why he had left the hotel room. Oh, he was looking for cell phone reception, wasn't he? Well,
yes, because he was going to call home to wish the family at home,
Merry
his
Christmas.
Mother and his sister, Merry Christmas.
So he left his wife, and he was going to go up to higher ground to try to get reception, and of course, that's when the tsunami
Well, hit. And then, yeah, and his wife was with her family,
mm-hmm.
so he just decided he would step out a few minutes to wish his family happy holidays, yeah.
And his pregnant wife and all of her family were killed. They all died in the tsunami.
Yeah.
That's a pretty depressing opening.
Yeah,
I mean, this is like chapter one, folks.
It's pretty devastating, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, okay, so what's the story?
It's all in the first few pages, you know. What? And this is a almost 400-page book. So.
Yeah.
Frank, we're talking about, and this, I don't know, I found this a little bit hard to believe. Despite his incredible grief, he draws on his past as a first responder, a police officer, and he tries to save people who might still be alive.
Well, I think he was part of the rescue unit, whatever the colony or wherever he was in Australia.
Oh, I didn't remember.
But you have to remember, too, when this was all coming about, there was no confirmation that he had indeed lost his wife and their unborn child. He didn't find that out, I think, until maybe the day later or something. So I think he was still kind of working on certainly adrenaline and hope.
Well, he did rescue this one little boy, three-year-old child.
Yes.
Who was in a partially submerged
vehicle that was going under.
Sort of car or something. That was going down. And the little boy's brother was there, too.
Colin, yes.
Yeah. And Colin, you know, they pulled him out of the sinking car, whatever it was. I don't remember the details. That was 400 pages ago.
Yeah, I know.
But Colin said something about, he handed him the little three, he said, take my brother, he's special, or
he's
something
special.
To that effect.
Exactly, he did, because Colin, we didn't find out until, you know, three quarters of the way into the story how old Colin was, which he, I think, was 7 or 8. Mm-hmm. So he literally, as the vehicle was being submerged in this water, lifted out, handed out his little brother, and I think he absolutely said those words, save him, he's special.
So Frank obviously saved the little three-year-old boy. And then eventually, we're truncating here for the interest of time, he bonds with this little boy. Well, of course, first he finds out that his wife and their unborn child are dead.
Right, and he really doesn't have anything. I think he had one brother-in-law who survived that was in the hospital, and he did go and say goodbye to him, but he literally really had no ties now to keep him in Australia.
Yeah, it was his wife's family who
Correct.
Was wiped out. His mother was still alive back on the horse farm in Wisconsin.
And his sister, and her husband, his brother-in-law.
Mm-hmm. So he decides to go back home to Wisconsin. And he decides to take the little boy.
He does.
Mm-hmm. Now, this would, of course, be totally illegal.
Yeah, because he should have, I suppose, reported it to the American Red Cross or the Red Cross, something.
Is there any living family?
That says, right, let's search to see whatever procedures, you know, that are in place to go through policy and procedure when something like this happens. And for some reason, he chose not to.
Did you have any trouble believing that? That as a former police officer, he would so blatantly skirt the law? I don't want to say break the law. Obviously, he had bonded with the little tyke.
Well, he was a retired officer. And I found myself, I suppose, making excuses as to how or why he would do this so that it would be somewhat believable for me, because I did find that part probably the most unbelievable. And then I'm thinking, well, he had found out that he had lost his wife and, you know, their unborn child, which he was really looking forward to.
Devastating, yeah.
And then for some reason, you know, he bonded with them and he made the decisions that he made. And the next thing you know, little three-year-old Ian is on the airplane with him on his way home.
He kind of thought that it was meant to be, you know.
Well, and you have to remember, Ian had special powers.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he could. Pardon me if I roll my eyeballs a little bit on this part, Kathy.
You can't see this, but David is rolling his eyes.
Well, I don't know. It's just that I've read a couple or three books in the last year and a half where there have been children with special powers, and I'm about ready to let that go for a while, you know. But this kid can—he can make other people do what he wants them to do, supposedly, or at least calm down and
pretty much to do what is right.
Yeah, mm.
You know, and it wasn't, you know, until actually you and I are just now speaking that it dawned on me. We find it unbelievable that Frank would do this, but really now, was it Frank or was it Ian and his special powers that wanted to make it happen?
Because to get this kid out of Australia, you can't just get on an airplane with an undocumented
kid. He got fake ID and
Remember the guy that he went to get the forged papers was a little hesitant. And then Ian went to work on him, you know, and suddenly I guess we can do this, you know.
Right. Well, and there again, I think the whole way through the book, it was stressed, you know, that he focused on, little Ian focused on doing what was right. Because you have to remember, this is in the mind of a three-year-old. But I think he was a pretty smart, intelligent 3-year-old.
Yeah.
But it was always doing what was right, and it was always toward the positive. It was never anything, although I think there were some times that he manipulated, especially Frank's mother, with, do you remember him, her coming home with this big, large aquarium with fish in it?
Yeah, he was especially helpful with animals, too. We're talking about little Ian now. Not only with human beings could he calm them down, but he could, well, you know, pardon us, Dr. Doolittle, he could talk to the animals, too.
He was almost like a little mini horse whisperer or animal whisperer, you know, that he actually connected with them.
Well, they decide, Frank decides to take the boy and go back home to the horse farm in Wisconsin, where his mother is still alive, his father's dead, his mother's still there, and his sister's there. His sister's name is Eden.
Yes.
And they're running the horse farm, which is called Tenacity, right?
Yes, yes. And I think it was just mentioned briefly, but wasn't Frank's father a horse trainer?
His name was Francis. I wrote that down on my my name chart here when I started to get confused. Yeah, there are horses throughout this whole thing. This was a pretty successful horse farm that they had
in
Wisconsin.
Yeah, and I think how he ended up in Australia was because the family that he was very close with in Australia, other than his first wife and her family, that he worked with the horses. I believe the man in that situation worked for his father at one time back at the States. And when his father passed away, he went back home. And his wife happened to be from England.
Is that the Pat?
Yes.
Is that his name, Pat? Yeah.
Yes.
Because he's in the rest of the story. Yeah, the caretaker for the horses.
Yes, yes. He comes back to the United States
with
Frank and
Ian.
He does. He becomes a main character in the story.
Okay. Yeah. Well, anyway, they go back to Wisconsin, and the mother. I'm getting ready to roll my eyeballs again, listeners. Frank Mercy's mother's name is Hope. So she is, are you ready? Hope Mercy.
She is.
As I read one critic, it said, Jacqueline Michard is not too subtle with her choice of names. Hope Mercy. But seemingly, she's in her, 70s, I think? I forget. Well, she has to be. This guy's, although he's a retired cop, he's on disability, he's still a fairly young guy.
Yeah.
I think she was in her 70s. I know she is by the time they go to England. But anyway. Let's take a break. We'll pick up a little more of the story again. We're not going to, obviously, I think once or twice we've revealed the ending to a book just because we had to or because we felt like we were going to do it.
Yeah.
But we won't do it for you and this, because this actually is part, what we've described so far might make it sound like almost a romance. It's part
it's
mystery,
just kind
too.
Of the backdrop of what starts swirling about.
A lot of mysterious stuff. We'll take a break. We'll talk more about this woman is a huge New York Times bestseller, Jacqueline Michard. And for those of you who are fans of Jacqueline Michard, maybe you've not read that. This is her latest.
It
was just published a couple of months ago. I've got the hardback in my hand here. It doesn't even look like it's been circulated through the library much yet. It must have just arrived, huh?
Yeah, I think two or three times maybe, yeah.
At any rate, she's tremendously popular. This is her 10th novel for adults, as Kathy mentioned. She's written a bunch of other stuff, too. So she's a pretty popular writer. We'll continue our conversation about her here on It's Your Turn in just a moment. One of our sponsors on the program today is Butler County Ford, your Ford Corner, Main and Wayne in downtown Butler since 1918. Been around for a while, folks. I think they've earned the right to brag a little bit about that. There's not a lot of businesses around here that can say they've been around for 100 years, especially at the same location. There's a reason that Butler County Ford is still here. It's the way they've treated their customers. They've got repeat customers for generations. They've got customers from far away. Last time I was down chatting with the folks, they said they have a lot of customers, even from south of Pittsburgh, that come to Butler County Ford to buy their cars and trucks. There's a reason for that. They like the way they get treated there. And the service after the sale is exemplary as well. Nowadays, you can find out a lot of information about cars before you even go. Check out the website, butlercountyford.com. All their inventory is there, for example. Every single car, truck, or SUV that they've got in stock is listed there, and that's new and used. You can review model research at butlercountyford.com. Learn all about financing. They'll let you know if they have any super hot specials or national deals. And when it comes time for a test drive, they've got a $25 gift card to Texas Roadhouse for taking a test drive. Sound pretty good? You bet. You bet. Butler County Ford since 1918 at your Ford corner, Main and Wayne, downtown Butler. They make your buying experience really easy.
The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location, downtown Butler, to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler.
Welcome back, listeners. It's a book talk day, and we welcome Kathy Klein from North Trails Public Library. And the book chosen for discussion this month is Two If by Sea, the latest novel from New York Times bestselling author Jacqueline Michard. We were talking about how the main character, certainly one of the two main characters, Frank Mercy, lost his wife. And this all happens literally in the first chapter.
It's not a long chapter.
No. So he goes back to Wisconsin. His mother is there, Hope Mercy, kind of helping to run the farm.
Taking care of her father-in-law.
That's true.
Jack. Was his name Jack?
I don't remember. I wrote down as many names as I could. the name of the farm is Tenacity.
Yes.
And it's not all that long after Frank arrives that his eye is caught. He catches the eye of another woman, Claudia Campo, whose father was a physician or a veterinarian? I can't remember. But at any rate, she is an equestrian, a horse rider.
Right, but by profession, isn't she a psychologist or like that?
She's a psychologist, but she's an excellent horse rider because she wants to be in the Olympics. She wants to ride in the Olympics.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she does.
So they meet each other and sparks fly.
Didn't they meet at his sister's, was it a wedding? Because when he came back, Sister Eden was engaged. I don't remember the brother-in-law's name.
Marty,
there you go. And I believe that because Marty and Claudia worked together at the same facility.
Oh, at the hospital or clinic or
whatever. Yeah, and he invited her. They were friends, and he invited her to their wedding. And that's where they first met.
Didn't this seem a little soon to you?
Yes.
He just lost his wife and their unborn child in a tsunami. And, I mean, it wasn't like, you know, the next week, but...
No, but it was kind of within 6 months.
Yeah, it seemed like, I don't know.
A little shallow, huh?
Well, a little bit.
Yeah, you know. Yeah.
But on the other hand...
But then again, he was out rescuing and not knowing, you know, if his first wife was dead or alive, you know. So.
Well, when sparks fly.
I guess.
And Frank, Mercy, and Claudia end up getting married.
They do.
Mm-hmm. Of course, it's convenient that he has a horse farm. And that she wants to ride in the Olympics.
Well, that was the purpose that Marty, because he knew what her aspirations were.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was the purpose of him introducing the two of them because she was looking for a trainer. and they thought that they could kind of talk Frank into doing that. Because did you get the impression, I always got the impression through the story that, because his father, I think, was, I got the impression, a well-known horse trainer, you know, in that industry, a lot of folks assumed that Frank would be too. And I always got the impression that he was, he never wanted to embrace it.
Well, I think he did. Well, of course, he couldn't work as a police officer anymore. I mean, he was disabled. I mean, he could still get around. He limped a little bit. He had a pain in his leg. But I think that's when he began to embrace these. And, well, you know, he was a hard worker. He was very tenacious.
Yes.
He was a little bit of a mama's boy. In fact, he admitted that to Claudia in the course of their meeting and courtship and so on. He didn't try to hide it.
Correct. He was a mama's boy.
Mm-hmm. So life goes on. Claudia, and for the sake of a novel, this is wonderful. She happens to be, she's in the field of medicine. She's a psychologist.
Yes.
So she, you know, he provides her with a horse facility, horse training. She helps him get over his grief with the loss of his wife and child. That's what she does. She's a psychologist. She counsels people.
Yeah. Well, did he spend as much time with her training, or I think he had Pat. Wasn't it Pat that kind of took her?
Well, who gave her the horse? Glory B ended up...
Correct. Glory B...
Glory B is a horse, folks.
Yeah, Glory B is a horse. You got to get to know the horses as much as you do the human characters
they
in
all
this
got
story.
Named. And by the way, I'm getting ready to roll my eyeballs again. They named the Mercy family named all of their horses. It's like the cherubim and the seraphim. They named all their horses after a heavenly. Glory B was the one horse. Another one was. All Saints. Another one was Gloria and Excelsis.
Yeah, I don't remember all.
all of the horses had these.
Well, what was the name of her horse? Because Glory B was Frank's horse.
I don't remember.
Because he's the one that really ended up excelling over her horse, which is the one she wanted to ride and do the trial runs
to get to
the Olympics. Yeah.
Well, I had a hard enough time keeping track of the people, let alone the horse's name. And again, if you're a horse lover, you love this book. There's horses all through it. And I don't know a whole lot about horses. I assume some of the critiques that I read from people who are horse lovers, they said it was wonderful detail on the show jumping and the grooming of the horses and all this.
It really gave
thing.
You a nice taste and feel of that whole environment.
Mm-hmm. On the other hand, some might think it got a little slow whenever they were going into all of the detail about the
Yeah, you just want to say, okay, yeah, go ahead, yeah.
Let's move it along here, Jacqueline.
Yes, yeah. Obviously, I don't hang out at the horse tracks or any of the facilities because I was kind of that way too. Okay, that's nice. But you can't skip anything because you never know what you might miss.
Why did they end up... Well, no, we have to talk about something else first. There are bad guys who enter the scene here.
Yeah.
And that's when this becomes kind of a mystery thriller.
It is, and that's where I wish she would have expanded on it a little more. I mean, I know they were bad guys, and throughout the story, especially probably the middle part and going on toward the end, that you find out these bad guys were kind of after Ian.
Yeah, they were after this is several years later now, but they were after the kid with the gift, the telepathic
Exactly.
Power. Now, I was mystified as to where these guys come from. Australia, that's where the kid was from. They wanted to get him back. But what was the nature? Who were they? I never quite
understood
that.
I didn't either, because she didn't go down that particular lane.
And she consistently referred to them just as bad guys.
Yeah, and I think probably toward the very end, she threw out a couple names. But that's where this story, for me, fell just a little short.
Mm-hmm.
Because I wanted to know why, in more detail, why they were after him. What had Ian done for them that they would go to such dire straits to get him back? You know, put themselves in jeopardy. Because they followed the whole way to the United States.
Mm-hmm. And eventually to England.
And eventually to England.
Now, I had problems, a few problems with this book, too. By the way, there are lots of good things. In fact, I want to make time to read a couple of passages. She's a very good writer.
She is.
But I've not read any of her other stuff, so I don't know. It just seemed to me like she couldn't decide what she wanted to do with this novel.
It
I referred
was very
to it
busy.
Earlier as a sweeping epic. I think if taken one or two elements, it would have been a better book. You know, is it going to be the mystery thriller where these killers, actually, they're more than bad guys,
well,
are
sure.
after Ian? Is it going to be a horse story? Is it going to be more of a romantic thing, you know, like a Hallmark Channel movie or something like
mm-hmm,
that?
Mm-hmm.
All of these are noble work, but it seemed like she just tried to mix them all into one bowl, and I don't think she ever quite realized where she was going.
Maybe it will make an excellent movie because there is so much going on. It would keep that, you know, those scenes rolling and moving.
Well, it could be. It might be a six-hour movie, too.
Well, I thought though too that I could very well see where this book, she could have focused on Frank, and the devastation of the tsunami, losing of his first wife, all that was going on, and his relationship with Cedric and Pat and whatever in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I could see that that could have been drawn out into a little more detail and depth. That could have been like book one, you know. She could have picked up on a sequence, you know, once they made it to the United States.
I see what you're talking about. A lot of writers do that.
They do
have a sequel and then even a third or fourth book with the same set of characters.
Mm-hmm.
That could have worked. Yeah, I just wasn't quite sure that she knew where she was going with
yeah,
it.
Like you, I do like her. I like her writing. I like her storylines. I think she's very creative. And it's just in this one area I wanted a little more taste of, okay, who are these bad guys? What are they doing? Because at one point I thought, well, are they like, you know, were they like gangsters, mafia? Or was it another inner circle somewhere that, because I don't know that much about Australia, you know, to know if they have organizations like that.
Mm-hmm.
Who were they? How did they even get a hold of?
Yeah, how did they track
Ian?
Them down?
Yeah,
they just left up in the air. Didn't it? If I'm reading a thriller, and I love to read good mm-hmm. Thrillers or spy novels, I'm a stickler for details. I don't want there to
you
be loose ends.
You don't want any loose ends.
That don't make sense. You know?
Yeah.
We're talking about Two If by Sea, the latest by New York Times bestselling author Jacqueline Michard. It's a brand new book, really, just a few months old. I have no idea how it's doing. She has a legion of fans, so
there
it's probably
is a waiting
doing pretty
list
well.
For it.
Is there really at the library?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'll have to make sure I get my copy back into circulation as quickly as possible. All good. Mine's from your library, North.
Exactly.
Trail, so
I'll take it. Yeah, I'll
it
take
can
it.
Go
with
right
me.
Back
yep.
On the shelf. Let me, because I don't want to sound like I'm totally critical of this writer. I wanted to read it, maybe even a paragraph or so here. This is when. It's the final third of the book. It's the when they go to England. So they're
yes.
they're on their third continent now, in Europe. Hope, Frank's mother, is still alive. She's well up in her 70s, and she is. They're packing. They're breaking up the Tenacity farm, the horse farm. They're moving lock, stock, and barrel to another run-down old horse farm in
that he had been, he inherited from Cedric in Australia, which
mm-hmm.
that's where she was originally from.
But it's in Yorkshire, which is a gorgeous part of England.
Mm-hmm.
If they make a movie, that would be the prettiest part,
pretty,
I think.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's. I felt like I was reading, you know, a Bronte novel or something like that when it got to when they moved to Yorkshire. But here is what. They were getting ready to pack and getting ready to move, and Hope is becomes very pensive. This is the mother now, the woman. She's well up in her 70s. She's lived in this home all of her life. And just listen to this. Listen to this writing. She looked at things she certainly would not need. An ancient set of embroidered towels, a nest of cast iron cake baking mugs, 1,000 hardcover books, and treasured them unreasonably. For the first time since Frank could remember, she seemed querulous. One day, as she was preparing tags for the auction to come, she said, "It's not these things. It's what I see as I sort them out. I fed my babies in this kitchen. It may be fixed up, but it's still my kitchen. I still see the same trees and fields and hills out the window. I roasted 100 turkeys. I sat up late at this table doing bills, doing the dishes while a thunderstorm rolled up over those hills." And she reminisces on what it means to be leaving this house and going to England. I just thought that was beautiful.
It was beautiful because she wasn't focusing on the items, the material things. It was all the memories that were associated. And, you know, and I think that's something that we can all relate to.
Absolutely. Her son comes in and says, you know, we got a roll here. You know, you're not going to need this. You're not going to need that. And she says, it's not these things. It's what they make me remember.
Yeah.
That's the
and he had a, I think he had an excellent relationship with his mother.
Oh, yeah.
I know he was a you know, a mama's boy, but he went and he talked to her and she knew when something was wrong. You know, and she just, and she was, she didn't mince words with him. She pretty much, you know, told him. And I think that's why for him, when they were packing, it was so different because there was a, that part of her that he maybe had never seen before.
How did the fact that he, I hate to use the term mama's boy, it's so, you know, derogatory. How did the way that he dealt with his mother and got along with his mother, did that affect his marriage with Claudia? You know, his second wife, did she, I mean, she's a psychologist. He never tried to hide this from her.
No.
He was very open about it.
No, and the fact, you know, when we say, well, he was a mama's boy. But when you stop to think about it, even though mama's boy, he became a police officer in Chicago from Wisconsin, ended up, he's in Australia. Then he moves back home. Even though being a mama's boy, it never tied him down. He still had free will. Mama never played the guilt trip on him or anything. I mean, he freely made his decisions.
And she's in her 70s, well up in her 70s. Yes. His father is dead. I think it's admirable that he would take special care of his mother under those circumstances.
Yes, and I would think, although she doesn't elaborate on it, but I would think that it would give Claudia some comfort that if, you know, treating his mother this way with the respect, that it would be, you know, some sense of a window opening that she could expect the same respect.
Does Jacqueline Michard, the author of Two If by Sea, does she go into detail about why they decide to move to England? Obviously, he inherited this property, but I mean they had a horse farm in Wisconsin.
I think they were trying to get away from the bad guys. Mm-hmm. I think it was as simple as that, because they had him in. Ian, and then remember, by this time, Colin, the older brother, they find out that he is still
alive
because he thought that he died when that vehicle completely submerged in the water in the tsunami. And then I forget, I think it was the brother-in-law that was still in Australia sent him this clipping of a newspaper or something, and things connected, and the next thing you know, Ian's brother is living with them.
And they brought the other boy back to live with them too, Colin.
Yes, yes.
So they had the two brothers reunited. I don't know whether they were ever officially adopted.
Well, because remember, he was being taken care of by some nuns in a convent.
In Australia.
Something. Yeah. And this is how they kind of, and then he ends up, but then what happens is the bad guys start, things start happening at their farm in Wisconsin. Because remember Pat, his buddy Pat, that traveled from Australia with him to the United States, and he went someplace in Illinois that did some kind of a lecture or a talk, and he ends up bringing this young woman that actually ends up working on the farm or whatever.
Oh, yeah. Was it? Lynette was her name, right?
Sounds about right.
Yeah.
And here it ends up that she's kind of connected with them somehow.
Yeah. Yeah, but what I did not get is, and again, this is my, I don't have to be super critical, who am I, best-selling author, but if the bad guys followed, if they found out they were in Wisconsin from Australia and followed them there, mm-hmm. what makes him think they wouldn't be able to follow them to England, too? I mean, after all, he's shipping, did you see the shipping list of the stuff he takes? Where'd they get all the money? He ships a truck? A dump truck?
Hey,
can you imagine what that must cost?
Anything's possible, I guess.
There were several times when I rolled my eyeballs.
Well, the common sense does kick in because, you know, why didn't you just address these bad guys in the United States? Because common sense tells you, just as you said, David, that when you go to England, it's just going to be a matter of time. And if you remember, it didn't take much time at all.
No.
That they showed up at their estate in England, because I don't even know if they were completely unpacked, or Claudia finally went there a little later, and it wasn't too long after that these guys showed up.
Well, the women, his elderly mother, and Claudia stayed back in Wisconsin. The guys went, and it was kind of an advanced party because this home needed a lot. It was beautiful. You know, again, a scene out of...
Right.
Charlotte Bronte,
yeah.
But there was no furniture in there. So they go on this buying spree, and they're buying big kitchen stoves, double-wide refrigerators, beds, couches, all this. And I'm thinking, what? And yet they ship a truck. You know, they sell trucks in England. You could have bought a truck over there.
Well, yeah. when you were, that's kind of when I was rolling my eyes, when they were on their shopping sprees, because I'm thinking, how do you know this is the stove that they would want? Now, unless, of course, you're going to be doing all the cooking.
The only thing I could figure, you know, the truck still had tenacity painted on the doors on the side of the truck. And I thought, listen, you can be sentimental. And what? They have painters in England, too.
You could have
bought a new truck and had them paint tenacity on the side instead of shipping the truck. Oh, well. I think by this stage, this is well into the book. It's long. I'm thinking, let's get to the end here, Jacqueline. Let's see what happens.
Well, and that's where even, you know, like I said, for me, I enjoyed the book. I would have enjoyed it much better if I would have seen more characterization, more, you know, what makes these bad guys wanting to come in to get Ian, other than he had a special gift. We all understand that.
By the way, that didn't bother me as much as I thought it was going to. As I'm beginning to read, I'm thinking, couldn't it just be a kid? You know, does it have to be a kid with telepathic power? But that, other writers have used that. You know, prize-winning writers, Gabriel Garcia Marquez would always, well, not always, but many times introduced a little touch of magic into some of his best works.
Mm-hmm.
A writer that I know, I haven't talked to Randall Silvis in a long time from this area, he likes to put a little bit of magic, magical suspense into his novel. So that doesn't bother me as much as I thought it was going to. There are some really poignant moments. Do you remember the time? Oh, gosh, I'll never remember all the names. It's the grocer or the butcher in the town that they moved to. And, of course, their farm is out in the country, but Stead is the name of the village, Stead, Stead in Yorkshire. And it's either the grocer or the butcher or something who has the daughter with the mental disability, and she's not able to control herself. She, you know, she's an adult, but, you know, she gets drunk in the pubs and, you know, carries on inappropriately. And Claudia sends Ian to be with her for a while.
Oh, yes.
And he works his magic, and she calms down.
And
she's not.
Yes. Yes.
And whoever, the grocer, the butcher, whatever it is, says, boy, thanks. And he says, for what? And he says, well, your wife sent Ian over to talk to Rosie.
Rosie.
Your wife sent Ian over to talk to Rosie. And she's just wonderful now.
Yeah, that communication.
That poignant.
Yeah, well, and that is where, the whole way through the book, they do emphasize, what Ian was doing, and they would ask him when he finally decided to talk, because you remember, I don't know for how many months he had him, and he didn't talk until really Claudia showed up.
I forgot about that. He was mute. He just
didn't
say anything.
Right.
It was like he was on the autism spectrum.
Yeah, he kind of did some kind of a hand gesture.
Mm-hmm.
But it was always whenever they really started talking about his telepathic powers that he was always, what is right? What is right? And it's always like, what was good? And I got that, and the guys that were after him were after him for not positive good things. I think somewhere in the story, when she finally introduced a couple of them, that they were, at one point, they had used him for gambling or something. I don't know what it was. But, so it was like, well, you have these special powers, you use them for unhealthy things or healthy things. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to make sure that Ian's, telepathy was used for the good.
And the people who were after him, just the opposite.
And I think what it was is the people that were after him, I never really got a chance in reading to get to know the characters, because I found myself, I didn't know how I felt about them because I didn't know who they were. I couldn't dislike them because I didn't know who they were.
Mm-hmm.
Bad guys, you kind of want to dislike them.
This would be, the more I think about it, it would seem to be a tough. Some of her other works have been made into films. The first one, there was a big star who did it. Michelle Pfeiffer produced and starred in, what's the one about, The Deep End of the Ocean.
Deep End of the Ocean.
I did not see the film.
I did not either.
But this would be difficult. When a screenwriter adapts a novel to film, they always have to cut and truncate and everything else. You couldn't put every single detail in a film. It would be 2 days long. But this one would be difficult. Spread over three continents and...
You would definitely have to, I would think, focus on good versus evil with mm-hmm. these special powers. You couldn't go into all of the areas that she went into. And then, too, we forgot about, the times that she took Claudia. Remember Claudia had this friend that lived outside, I can't remember the town where she worked and where she was at there in Wisconsin, that had the same powers? Do you remember that? That she grew up and that...
I don't remember that, no.
Yeah, they took and they visited her. I can't even remember what her name was.
Was she trying to find out more about Ian and
correct
how to deal with him?
Correct, because this woman, she had met years ago, but this woman kind of stayed in her own little place, in her own little world. She had married, she had children, but she was talking to her as to how do you cope with this special gift? So she was given some kind of pointers on, what Ian may be exposed to as he grows older and stuff like that. But it was just a little snippet part of the book.
The timeline is a little vague in this book.
Yeah.
I found it difficult to know just exactly, when there's a new episode, how much time had passed.
Right.
Okay, how old are the kids now? And what, there are occasional references to the time of the year. Spring is coming, or it's a
but
bit cold
January. But I got the impression
that
all of this happened within the 12 months of when that tsunami happened in the story in Australia, because that was the only time frame that you actually knew because the story opens. It's Christmas Eve. Mm-hmm. You know what time of the year it is.
And it ends with some symbolism. And I have to try to be fair to Jacqueline Michard. I obviously don't know the woman. She talks about a new definition of heavenly host. I'm trying to think of how I can broach this subject without. I don't want to give away any of the ending. She talks about a new definition of heavenly host. And I know now that that's what she was going for with all of these roll-your-eyeball names. You know, all mm-hmm. the horses are named.
Sure.
Glory Be, Gloria in Excelsis, All Saints, because it was foaled on the day before Halloween, so they called mm-hmm. the horse All Saints. Mm-hmm. Even the names of some of the people.
Hope, Mercy. Yes. Well, even the last name that she had given her main character.
True. But, you know, she says something to the effect that... I realize now that a heavenly host is not a choir of angels singing in, you know, a glorious 15-part harmony, but it could be an army of angels. That's all I'll say.
Yeah.
So I know what she was going for. I'm just not sure that I buy it or that she got there. You understand what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
Because, you know, she tries to weave religious threads in
mm-hmm,
here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Not just with the names, but themes of, you know, good versus evil.
Then maybe that's why she didn't focus on the evil with the bad guys that were after Ian. And maybe her message simply was always that never give up, there's always hope, and good always prevails. Although, like I said, I just kind of wanted to know what evil intent these guys had.
I think she needed a good editor who could say, you know, she's obviously got a long list of bestsellers, and, you know, it might be hard for her closest friends to say, you know, take her side.
To critique it too much,
huh? Jacqueline, better cut this one down a little bit, you know.
Yeah. More of the bad stuff. That's
right.
You know, balance it out a little bit. Yeah.
And who knows, you know. Maybe this will turn out to be her biggest.
It will probably be her,
all time.
And it'll probably be the best movie ever, David.
That's right, make us look like idiots. Well, we don't do that. When we do book talk, you know, I mean, it would be silly if every time we did this, we said this is the greatest novel since the invention of sliced bread. Obviously, it can't be. And you know.
Well,
you're going to like some books, and I'm going to like some.
Exactly. And what I have always done is that whenever, for certainly the libraries up north that I help to represent, and the title was picked, I read the book, but I make sure that I never discuss it until I come here. And so our discussion is the first time that I personally have even discussed this book with anyone. You know, so
this is if you're a horse lover, and you love stories about horses, you'll love this book. And it's, you know, it's a fine romance with a little bit of bittersweet tragedy
mm-hmm.
in it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you like that kind of book, that's fine. I'm just not sure if you're looking for a mystery thriller that you'll be, that satisfied with it. Although there's certainly a component of that, Ian. There's no question about
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Like I said, I think that it is an absolute fine read. I kept wanting to turn the pages because, okay, where's she going with this? Where's she going with this? But I was on the mystery end of it. That's where my disappointment was.
I don't see anything in here that would make it unsuitable for younger readers. Do you?
No.
No. I didn't, you know, I've read
not at all
books with the, you know, far stronger language and mm-hmm. suggestive parts. Mm-hmm. I didn't find any of that in this book.
No.
Jacqueline Michard. We hope to heaven. Glory be.
Glory be. That's how we spell it. How we announce it.
We're pronouncing it correctly. Author of The Deep End of the Ocean. I might be tempted to rent that, you know, especially with Michelle Pfeiffer in mm-hmm. it, to rent the movie. But that would be, must be many, many years ago. Because that was her first book.
Oh, goodness, yes.
Yeah. Two If by Sea, Jacqueline Michard. Thanks for selecting this book.
You're welcome.
The folks at, is this next month?
It is.
Ooh. Frederick Bachman, A Man Called Ovi?
I'm not sure. It is a cranberry selection, either Ovi or Av. I don't know.
O-V-E. Oh, this looks, Simon and Schuster. I always look at the publisher.
I do too.
Because, you know, if it's a throwaway book, it might be a publisher you never heard of.
Correct.
Simon & Schuster, they don't publish everything.
That's correct.
And by the way, I believe Simon & Schuster published this one too.
I think you're right. I know you're right, yeah. Yeah.
Don't be put off too much by our minor criticism.
It's just our opinion.
Always fun to talk about books with you, Kathy.
Thank you, Dave. It's always fun to be here.
All righty. Kathy Klein from North Trails Public Library visiting with us. More to come. We're going to be talking about, well, we're going to be talking with a Nobel Prize winning economist on the next segment of the program today. Don't let that frighten you off. His name is Alvin E. Roth. We're going to be talking not so much about economics, certainly not economics with money. We're going to be talking about matching markets, where money is not the only factor in determining who gets what. Who gets what? That's the subject matter. Stick around. More to come on It's Your Turn. And don't forget, we're going to be ending the program a few minutes early today to join Pirate Baseball, the Bucks and the L.A. Dodgers, this afternoon at PNC Park. So we'll be wrapping up a few minutes early today. Back to talk with Alvin Roth after these words.
Do you have missing teeth or wear dentures? You may have heard of or are considering dental implants. Hi, this is Dr. Bob Todd of Butler Smiles Dental Care. There are many options available with dental implants, and making the right choice can be confusing. I have been placing dental implants since 2004, both full-size traditional implants and small diameter or mini dental implants. There are indications for both, but more and more we are using mini dental implants in a variety of innovative ways. They are easier to place, causing less discomfort, are less costly, and can frequently be used immediately after placement, allowing you to get back to eating the foods you like or smiling again right away. Traditional implants typically have a 4-month healing time before they can be used. I invite you to call our office at 282-7774 to schedule a free consultation to see if mini dental implants are the right solution for your dental problems, or visit us on the web at butlersmiles.com.
I'm going to be talking about who gets what and why, listeners, on the next segment of It's Your Turn. Nice to have you with us. If you're joining us a little bit late on this program today, welcome. My name is Dave Malarkey. Our guest joins us by telephone. He is Alvin E. Roth, winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics. Mr. Roth, nice to meet you. It's terrific to have you with us for a few minutes here today.
Well, thanks. It's nice to be back in Pittsburgh, even by telephone.
Yes. Do you have connections with Pittsburgh, sir?
Well, I taught at Pitt for many years.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm fascinated by your book, Who Gets What and Why. It's now in paperback, and that's why we're talking to you about it. The subtitle is The New Economics of Matchmaking and Market Design. Now, when I saw that you were a Nobel Prize winner in economics, I thought, oh, boy. Am I going to be in over my head talking about this with Mr. Roth? But no, I found your book fascinating, absolutely fascinating, sir.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. That's why we write them, you know.
Well, tell us a little bit about who gets what and why. We're talking here about, you know, a lot of people think when you're talking about economics, you're just talking about money. And you say there's much more to it than that. For example, who gets a spot in the freshman class at Yale, for example? Or even, and this is fascinating, who gets the right romantic partner and who doesn't?
That's right. So I talk a lot in my book about matching markets, which are markets where you can't just choose what you want, even if you can afford it, but you also have to be chosen. And so, you know, marriage is like that. You can't just choose your spouse. You also have to be chosen. And so is college admissions. You can't just show up and study at Yale. You have to be admitted. And so is getting a job. You can't just become a radio broadcaster. You have to be hired. So lots of markets don't just depend on price, but have all sorts of other market institutions that help them work and help people profit from coordinating and cooperating and competing with each other.
Well, you make this very easy.
And I think of the book.
Yes, go ahead, sir.
I think of the book as a field guide to markets. You know, if I wrote a field guide to flowers, then when you took a walk in the park, you'd notice different kinds of flowers than you did before. And the book is to help you notice different kinds of markets.
Mm-hmm. Well, you made this a lot easier for me to digest when you explained that successful marketplaces, successful ones, all have three main qualities, and I'd like to take a couple of minutes and talk about each of those, if that's okay with you. The first one is thickness. Now, what do you mean by that quality, sir?
Well, thickness, a marketplace makes a market thick when it encourages enough people to come together so that when you show up in the market, there's lots of opportunities for you. If the market were very sparse, it wouldn't be as productive. Think of Airbnb or Uber, for that matter. They're new marketplaces for rental housing and for cars. And what makes Airbnb a thick market is they started as a website in San Francisco, but they quickly started to buy similar websites in London and Berlin and other places. So today, if you want to go someplace in any big city in the world, and a lot of other places as well, you can find a room on Airbnb. And if you want to rent your apartment wherever you are, you might attract travelers from all over the world. And similarly, Uber would be a lot less interesting to get a taxi kind of ride if, when you opened the app, there weren't many cars around. So Uber depends for its success on being pretty thick so that they seldom have to say to you that no cars are available. And if you're a driver for Uber, you need lots of people on the other side of the market. So mm-hmm. when you open your app, you can find someone who needs a ride pretty quickly.
You also you give an example, which is very close to some of your work. You talk about a kidney exchange. To be a thick market, it means there has to be a huge database of patients and donors. And I understand that you actually designed such a system for kidney transplants.
That's true to some extent. You know, when I was at Pittsburgh in the 80s and 90s, University of Pittsburgh was a giant transplant center, did a lot of kidney and liver transplants in the United States. But there are never enough organs. There are always people on the waiting list. And one of the special things about kidneys is you can get an organ from a dead person, but because healthy people have two kidneys and can remain healthy with one, you can also get a kidney from a living person. And so if you're healthy enough to give someone a kidney, you might be able to save the life of someone you love who has kidney failure. But sometimes you're healthy enough to give someone a kidney, but you can't give them your kidney because kidneys have to be compatible. Not every kidney will work for everyone. Mm-hmm. So you might love someone enough to give a kidney and be healthy enough to do it, but they can't take your kidney. And what kidney exchange is about, the part of kidney transplantation that economists got involved in, is maybe you're an incompatible donor for your patient, and I'm an incompatible donor for my patient, but maybe I can give a kidney to the person you love, and you can give a kidney to the person I love. And so that's an exchange, the kind of thing economists study, that would help save two lives, get two transplants that wouldn't otherwise have happened. And that's a market where we don't allow money to work at all. It's against the law in the U.S. and in most of the world to buy a kidney.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a prime example of a market where there's not only is there no money, there's no money allowed. One of the other main qualities that you say all successful marketplaces share, there are three of them, we talked about thickness. The second one is the absence of congestion. What do you mean by that? Too many people, too many things?
Yeah, once you get a thick market, you come to the marketplace and there's a gratifying number of people there, but you can't make any sense of them. There are too many. They're all shouting. Mm-hmm. Think about how difficult it would be to navigate your supermarket if they didn't have signs on the aisles explaining what was in each aisle. That way you don't have to go down every aisle to find a can of tuna. Think how difficult it would be to buy anything on Amazon if they didn't have a powerful search engine that allowed you to find my book if you wanted to buy my book on Amazon, because they have lots of books and lots of other things. And basically, we don't see any markets that haven't learned to deal with congestion because they just become impossible to use if they don't. One of the examples I give in my book, again, is Airbnb. Think about their problem, because most of their hosts only control one room, one apartment, one house that they're renting. So think how difficult it would be to rent a hotel in Pittsburgh, say, if when you called up the hotel and wanted to ask if there were a room available for next Friday, they wanted you to ask about a particular room. So you'd say, how about room 1412? And they'd say, sorry, that room is taken. And so then you'd have to say, how about room 1312? How about room 1212? How about room 1213? And it would be hard, especially if they hung up on you after each inquiry when they didn't have a room. That's a little bit Airbnb's problem, because if you want to rent my guest room on Airbnb and it's already been taken, then you have to contact someone else and rent a room from a different person. And so Airbnb did a lot of work getting their hosts to respond quickly and making sure that even if I haven't given a reservation to someone yet for my room, if someone has applied for it, then you won't see my room, so you won't queue up behind someone else, and inevitably one of you will have to be told no.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes Airbnb easier to use, but it was a unique kind of hotel problem that Hilton Hotels doesn't have.
You also talk in your book, Who Gets What and Why, that the spread of smartphones made the Airbnb market uncongested. In fact, the spread of smartphones was essential to what you're talking about here.
I think it's even clearer with Uber. So think about when the Internet was invented. That made markets like Amazon possible and eBay. As soon as there was the Internet, there was no reason why you should sell the things in your garage by putting them out on the lawn and having a lawn sale. You could sell them on eBay. And you no longer needed to look for out-of-print books in used bookstores whenever you happened to be near one. You could go on Amazon and try to find them there. But Uber couldn't come into existence when the Internet was invented. Uber needed smartphones because to order a ride, your smartphone needs to know where you are. It needs to have GPS on it. And that makes it much easier to order a taxi than it used to be. And that wouldn't work at all if you had to go to your office and get on your office computer and try to order a taxi, because often you're not in your office when you need a taxi.
Yeah, the Internet and the smartphones. I know once several years ago, I was looking for a book. It was out of print. It was an older book. I found it in about 15 seconds at a used bookstore in Manitoba, believe it or not.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, in Manitoba, they don't use U.S. dollars, but they're happy to take your credit card over the Internet and send you the book. It becomes a very easy, safe market to use. You don't worry that they won't send you the book. You have no trouble with the currency exchange. So credit cards are a kind of marketplace too, a two-sided marketplace where on the one hand you need a lot of merchants who will take credit cards. That's what makes the credit card valuable to you. And they take them because there are a lot of customers who they couldn't sell to if they didn't have the credit card, right? If not only were you able to find that book in Manitoba, you were able to buy it because of all the different kinds of marketplaces that you're involved with.
Listeners, we have a few more minutes that we're able to chat with Alvin Roth. This book is funny. It's got a lot of common sense, a lot of uncommon wisdom, and some humor, too. We'll pick up our conversation with Alvin Roth here on It's Your Turn on WISR right after these words.
WISR 680, your classic hit station in Butler, will now conduct a test of the emergency alert system. This system is designed to provide you necessary information in the event of severe weather or a local emergency situation. This is only a test. This concludes this test of the emergency alert system here on WISR Butler.
After the loss of a loved one, we grieve. It can be a very lonely time. We're told that talking things out really helps. Talking things out with someone who understands, someone who cares. Thompson Miller Funeral Home in Butler offers Someone's Caring, a sensitive caring program that helps ease the emotional pain. Men and women are invited to attend, and we find that men are realizing that it's all right to express their emotions in our groups. It offers a sense of relief. We have five programs: a grief support group for those who have lost a loved one, for survivors of a suicide, for bereaved parents, for those who have lost a pet, and individual sessions. The programs are conducted by our own experienced bereavement specialist, Robin S. Miller. Call us at Thompson Miller Funeral Home to learn more. We can help you through this most difficult time. Thompson Miller Funeral Home at the corner of East North and McCain Streets in downtown Butler. Thompson Miller, time-honored excellence.
Welcome back, listeners. Joined us a little bit late on the It's Your Turn program here on WISR today. That's fine. My name is Dave Malarkey, our guest, and we're very pleased to be able to talk with Alvin E. Roth, winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2012, I believe, right? You were co-recipient of the Nobel Prize, Mr. Roth?
Yes, that was a big year for me. We moved to California as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, from because you had been at Pitt prior to that. He is now, listeners, the McCaw Professor of Economics at Stanford and one of the world's leading experts in the field of market design and game theory. There's one other quality, one of the three main qualities to a successful marketplace that we haven't mentioned yet, and I'd like to take a moment or so and talk about that, Mr. Roth. It's safety and reliability. Could you expand on that just a little bit?
Sure. When we were talking before, you said you'd bought a used book in Manitoba, and we talked about how you'd probably paid for it with a credit card. And credit cards give you a way to make a safe payment across a distance to someone you've never met before, the bookseller in Manitoba. And that expands the scope of markets. If you didn't have that kind of payment mechanism, you either would have had to trust, you and the seller would have had to trust each other a lot. You'd have to send him cash, and he'd have to send you the book. If you didn't have a credit card thing, or you'd have to confine your search to bookstores in Pittsburgh where you could look the bookseller in the eye and hand over the cash while he handed you the book. That's a safe transaction too. But having a safe payment method vastly expands your scope. And there's other kinds of safety when you rent a room on Airbnb. If you're the traveler, you want to be sure that the room is going to look like the picture. If you're the host, you want to be sure that the traveler is a responsible adult who will leave your apartment in orderly shape. And so internet markets have reputation mechanisms. You're going to be renting to a stranger, but the person has a record of successful rentals, and that gives you some confidence that this is a safe transaction. Confidence that you didn't need necessarily when you were going to a hotel and could inspect the room, or when you were buying something from a local merchant who had a shop and you knew other people who had bought from them and they'd been there for a long time.
Matching markets are everywhere, listeners, and you don't always need the internet or a smartphone either. Talk a little bit about, because you mentioned this in your book, an Aborigine tribe which arranges marriages for their unborn grandchildren. My goodness.
Well, there are lots of markets that that go very early. It's a kind of market failure sometimes when markets go so early you can't really tell what you're getting. For instance, if you know someone who's graduating from law school right around now, one of the fancy jobs that they could have is to be a clerk with an appeals court judge. But if they have that job, they got it 2 years ago in the summer after their first year of law school. Hmm. And that's because there's a lot of competition among judges and among law students to get these to match to these jobs, and the competition drives the market very early, makes it hard for the judges to know how good a law student someone will be after they've only completed 1 year of the 3 year law school period. So that's an example of a market that unraveled. And when I was looking for examples with markets unraveled, actually I was teaching at Pitt, and in the building that's now called Posvar Hall and was then called Forbes Quad, mm-hmm. the economics department sat together with the anthropology department, and I would go to coffee with my anthropology colleagues, and I would say to them, tell me about early marriages. And the marriages that I heard about got earlier and earlier. In India, they have trouble preventing child marriages, for example. But what I finally wrote about was, as you say, this Aboriginal tribe in Australia, in which a standard marriage contract is between a man with a pregnant wife and a man with a little boy, and the contract is not that the unborn child will be the spouse of the little boy, but that the first daughter, you know, the grandchild, because the unborn child is already married, hmm. right? The unborn child, if a girl, has been married a generation ago. Hmm. But the contract is not that she'll be the wife of the little boy, but she'll be his mother-in-law. And that's because that's when the contracts are made in that society. And so if you're a responsible father, you have to marry off your kids when the market is thick, when there's a chance to marry them with appropriate matches, which turns out to be very, very far in the future.
Let's take one more example that sports fans would probably be interested in. Markets for college bowl games. You talk about that in your book, too.
Absolutely. So today we've got the playoff series, which is meant to make sure that there's a good match at the end of the season so we can maybe have an undisputed champion. But for a long time, the NCAA tried to regulate the time at which colleges and bowls could agree with each other, and it regulated them very unsuccessfully, so that the NCAA tried to have a day called Pick'em Day, before which bowls and colleges wouldn't make agreements with each other. But that was regularly flouted. And so I remember a year, I think it might have been 91, where Notre Dame went to the Sugar Bowl four games before the end of the regular season. Hmm. And then they didn't win all those games. So what had looked like a number one team playing a number two team ended up being a number 17 team playing a number 24 team or something like that. And it turns out the television viewerships really suffer when there aren't good matchups. And so over the years, there was the bowl championship series. There were other attempts to make the matchups better at the end of the year by essentially delaying determining what the matchups were until the regular season was over.
We're talking, listeners, with Alvin E. Roth, Nobel Prize winner in economics. We're talking about his book, which has just gone into paperback, so it'll be more accessible to people. The title is Who Gets What and Why? I have to ask you one more question, Mr. Roth, because I see that you're well-known in the field of game theory in addition to market design. It just happens to be coincidental that over this past weekend, one of my favorite little movies was on Turner Classic Movies. It's called A Little Romance. I think it was perhaps the last film that Sir Laurence Olivier ever made. But one of the subplots is this young boy is 14 years old in Paris. He designs a computer program to pick the winning horse in one of the big races at Longchamp for somewhere outside of Paris. Is that possible for you people who are experts in game theory? Can you do stuff like pick winning horses?
If I could do stuff like pick winning horses, I'd be at Longchamp in Paris. Game theory is mostly about how people interact with each other. And of course, there's people interacting with each other in horse races, but there's also an element of chance, right? So there are lots of things that are games, but game theory is about games of strategy. So things that we can hope to do with game theory, picking winning horses is not anywhere near the top of the list.
Listeners, the title of the book, Who Gets What and Why, by Alvin E. Roth. He's been our guest for the last few minutes here on It's Your Turn. Thank you for your time, sir. Very interesting. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So long now.
Bye. Bye.
Midday lottery numbers for you today. The pick two was 98, 98. The pick three is 999. Three nines, 999. The pick four, 9044. The pick five, 53316. The treasure hunt, 9, 10, 11, 24, and 25. Estimated jackpot for tomorrow's treasure hunt is $10,000.
Moving from my home of 50 years was a little scary, but I wasn't safe at home anymore, and my daughter with her busy life, children and grandchildren, it wasn't fair for me to expect so much from her.
We looked together to find a new home and discovered New Haven Court at Clearview.
What made the difference were the employees and the residents we met. The residents said it was a great place to live.
New Haven Court at Clearview, a great place to live because it's a great place to work. 888-261-5753 or visit IntegraCare.com.
Hop the bus, leave the driving up to us.
The bus.
We're going your way, getting there starts here. Just hop the bus, easy and economical. Just hop the bus, no car, no problem. The bus will get you there, 'cause that's what we do. Hop the bus, leave the driving up to us.
The bus.
We're going your way.
Atlas used his shoulder to hold up the world. You just want to toss a frisbee, hit a golf ball, or shoot some hoops with your kids. Standing between you and your ability to participate is shoulder pain. Maybe your knees and hips are giving you some trouble as well. Tri River Surgical Associates physicians treat orthopedic injuries with arthroscopic techniques designed to reduce pain and speed recovery. Don't let an injury hurt your performance. Call Tri River Surgical at 866-874-7483. On the web, tririversortho.com.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to be leaving a little bit early today, a couple of minutes early, to join Pirate Baseball. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we've got some open talk time, plus the director of VA Butler Healthcare will be with us, and that's David Cord visiting with us on tomorrow's program. It's your turn here on WISR. We thank our guests from earlier today, Kathy Klein from North Trails Public Library, and Alvin Roth, our last guest. I'm Dave Malarkey. Enjoy the rest of your Monday. We'll see you tomorrow on It's Your Turn. Pirate Baseball coming up on WISR next.
This is Butler's hometown radio station, where you wake up with Dave Malarkey every weekday morning starting at 5:30. Complete local news, sports, and weather as the sun comes up, only on WISR, 680 AM Butler.
Butler Media Group Marketing Department specializes in helping local businesses grow through cost-effective, targeted advertising. With the right audience and enough frequency, your advertising dollars can provide a tangible return on investment. Our goal is to make your job easier by providing radio for every lifestyle, meaning with unique radio formats, we can reach enough of the right customers to positively impact your business. The secret formula for advertising success comes down to this: what you say times how many times you say it. Call us today for more information or visit our website at InsideButlerCounty.com and click on Advertising. The Butler Media Group family of radio stations. We live here, we employ here, we spend our money here, and we'll help your business make more money. I'm Kathy Gregory Steiner, and I love what we do. Thank you.